Cutting the noise, mapping the moves, explaining what matters and what does not. Welcome to The War Room with Dr. David Katz, your weekly briefing on military strategy and the conflicts shaping our world.
Welcome to The War Room. My name's David Katz, and I'm happy to say that we have a foundation of good news. Our rand is trading strongly at 16.23 at my last look. The oil price is below $70, so that augurs well. And I've just heard on the news now that our mayor has announced that our city, Johannesburg, has been re-rated from super junk to just junk. So what can go wrong? I mean, these are very positive things to set the mood for tonight's talk that we are going to have. So tonight on The War Room, I want to turn my attention to a battlefield that is not measured in kilometers, casualties or territory, but in narratives, credibility, and public trust. So for more than a century, traditional or legacy media, newspapers, radio, television, and professional journalism helped societies understand war, politics, and the wider world. It reported, interpreted, investigated, that's a term that we're going to look at today, challenged power, and at its best, provided a common factual ground from which citizens could think and argue. Or maybe not, we're going to see tonight. But that world has changed dramatically. Social media has shattered the old information order. News now travels instantly. Opinion often outruns fact, and influence is no longer confined to editors, correspondents, and broadcasters. In war especially, information has become a weapon, shaping morale, confusing publics, mobilizing support, and attacking trust itself. So tonight I want to ask, what is the role of legacy media now? Has it been overtaken by social media, or does it still offer something essential? Verification, context, judgment, and accountability. Has traditional media become a casualty of hybrid warfare, which is something we've discussed on previous programs, or is it one of the last defenses against it? So helping me explore this tonight, I'm joined by Brooke Spector, well known to everybody, retired American diplomat, journalist, commentator, former academic, one of the original Daily Maverick team, and presenter of The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector right here on Chai FM. Welcome, Brooks.
Good evening. Good to be with you. It's interesting to be a guest rather than an interviewer.
Well, I'm returning the favor because
That's true. That is true.
So it's going to be good for you to look at it from a different perspective. We're going to pick your brain tonight mercilessly to try and find out what's going on. But before we do that, you know, I did a Google search on you. I tried to, because you're very interesting. First of all, just to start, you've got a magnificent name. I mean, it suits exactly. You know, it conjures up all different types of ideas. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I've tried to have a look at your career, and it's eclectic. I mean, you've been all over the place, from diplomat to be involved in theater and that type of thing. Just give me a little bit of a background about yourself.
It shouldn't be confusing. I mean, I joined the American Foreign Service in my 20s, in the middle of the Vietnam War, no less.
Yes.
And I was in a military reserve unit at the time, and that had all kinds of complications in my life. And then I served, we served in Indonesia twice, and then Japan for 10 years, and South Africa three separate times, and in Eswatini once, and then short periods in Nigeria and Namibia.
As part of the diplomatic corps, Brooks? As part of the diplomatic corps, yeah.
And I did a stint as one of the managers at the Voice of America in its heyday.
Aha, I remember that.
Dealing with the Indonesian language broadcasts. Uh-huh. And When we were about to retire, we were sitting in our dining room in Johannesburg, and my wife, who was locally born, looked at me and said, by the way, now that you're retiring, you should understand I'm staying. What is your plan? Now, what exactly do you do with that?
No, that was one of my questions. Why did you prefer staying here instead of going back to the United States of America? Now I know it was under duress. It wasn't because you preferred the South African situation. It was pure duress.
Well, No, I mean, part of the thinking was, if I went back to Washington, I would be one of hundreds of recently retired Foreign Service officers looking for a way to plug into an already vast and overarching world of commentary and research, and I would just be one more person with experience in several countries, some deep experience maybe, but just, like so many others. I got lots of opportunities here as a result. I mean, I did two research stints, one at Wits University and then one with the University of Johannesburg. We wrote a book on the history of the Joburg Civic Theater, among other things. And radio and TV stations in this country and elsewhere decided that I was a reasonable person to take complicated, difficult to nuance topics and make them clear, not simple, but clear. And just, if you could do it in 10 minutes, 5 minutes, then you were a star. So we started getting requests from places as far afield as China Global Television and Turkish Television to do the same thing. The one thing I haven't wanted to do is to take opportunities to talk about South Africa's domestic circumstances. So I routinely pass off on the idea that I would provide a commentary on, say, Julius Malema's most recent difficulties or something like that. I figured that there are obviously people here who could do it better and know more about it than I do.
Okay, it's pretty from a point of that you do have an opinion, but you feel that there are people better informed than you to pass comment on our local situation in many ways.
No, absolutely. I mean, they've lived it and looked at it, and that's their professional purpose in life. And I think it's only fair that they should do it. Of course, I have opinions, but those are just the opinions of many other people who would have similar informed but not expert opinions. And so I try to focus my attention mostly on either American issues or international issues that have an American aspect to them. And people seem to like that, so that's where we be.
Yes. Okay. Well, on that note, that's great. Thank you. Let's have a look at discussing, an international problem, not just here in South Africa. I think everybody is facing it. And I want to pose this question to you. Is the legacy media dying? Is it already dead? And giving that answer to me, what was its original function? And does it still play that function now to a lesser extent or the same extent? Give me some observation about that.
Well, I mean, years and years ago, back when you and I both were young, you had television, you had radio, and you had daily newspapers and magazines, periodicals that arrived. And in the United States, as a child, obviously, at 7 o'clock in the evening, you turn on the television, and there would be a newscast for 15 or 30 minutes from one of three networks. In the morning, you'd hear a thud at the door, and there would be a newspaper that had been delivered. And you had somebody like Walter Cronkite, who would close his broadcast on CBS News and look right into the camera and say, "And that's the way it is, Tuesday, November 15th." And you believed it because why would Walter Cronkite lie to you? He couldn't. He was Uncle Walter. Or if you were of such a mind, you'd watch the Huntley Brinkley report, and you'd get pretty much the same response. What has changed quite clearly is that the news cycle has become 24/7. And this you can blame on or applaud the impact of Ted Turner. Ted Turner is the man who thought of and conceived and gave birth to, that's redundant, isn't it? Thought of and gave birth to the cable news network, otherwise known as CNN. And his plan was to have people giving news all the time and updating it periodically so that you always had the newest information that could be brought to bear, but you would get it constantly. And so you would leave, people in certain occupations would leave it on all the time. Now, they they created that that idea, but they won big when the Challenger space shuttle exploded in air. They were the only people who could cover it immediately, constantly, and update it all the time. Then in the first Gulf War, they had three reporters in Baghdad who could provide minute-by-minute coverage of what was happening inside Iraq, rather than simply relying on Defense Department handouts or reports from Pentagon-based reporters. And George Bush, who was president at the time, George Herbert Walker Bush, was quoted as saying he found that CNN gave him better information than the CIA. And I mean, that's a phenomenal thing to think about.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, yes. I mean,
but now the wheel.
Carry on.
Sorry,
Brooks,
I was just going to add, now the wheel has changed further in that you have this business of citizen reporter. Anybody with a video camera or a smartphone that can take images can claim to be a journalist, put their material, whether it is biased or attempts at truthfulness and coherence, they can put it on the internet almost instantly.
Yes,
and
yes.
They influence the way we think about whatever the event is.
But Brooks, something else has happened also, is that, I mean, I remember the good old days, so do you, that I won't say that CNN was neutral by any means, and certainly, I mean, we can argue about its objectivity on certain matters. But these days, a news outlet such as CNN or Fox News are completely partisan. I mean, they've taken on the cudgels for let's say CNN for the Democrats, Fox for the Republicans. They make no bones about it, and they've become a mouthpiece for these parties. I mean, you no longer go to CNN to hear a balanced report. You'll go to CNN to reinforce your point of view. If you happen to be pro-democratic or whatever, that's the place that you're going to go to. Is that something that's changed?
Well, years and years ago, before either of us were born, before our great-grandparents were born, newspapers in Britain, in the United States, in France, any place else that they might have existed, were ruthlessly partisan. And they wouldn't simply gleefully report the problems of a candidate of the party they didn't like. They would ruthlessly attack them and provide all manner of scurrilous rumors and reports, truthful or not. That evolved into the kind of ethos that, say, the New York Times would say to you, all the news that's fit to print. Now, you know, fit to print is a, you know, who knows exactly what that means? I mean, perhaps that means we're not going to invade the private space of everybody who's in the A-list. And I would take issue with CNN's politicization. I watch it a lot, but I balance it with five or six other sources. Mm-hmm. And first thing in the morning, by the time I've had breakfast, I've gone through four or five newspapers globally and newsletters. And then I have friends in the U.S. who keep throwing articles from sources that I hadn't looked at, saying, you have to read this too. It's a desperate effort to try to get a larger picture, to get not just the views of people, but the nuances that are behind those views. But it takes work. I mean, it's not something you can just automatically do. And that's that really is part of the challenge. But let's take, for example, and I'm sure this will be controversial, you'll get calls and you'll have all manner of people baying after my throat or head after this. There have been any number of people in Gaza and elsewhere in the Middle East who hold up a smartphone, take their images of what's happening, and offer it to the world as if it is the truth, as opposed to simply one of a dozen competing truths.
Yes.
And it's now up to the consumer of all this information, too much really, to be able to pick their way through it. I was fascinated by the way you defined this, and I looked up. I'm sure you're familiar with George Orwell's essay "Politics in the English Language,"
Yes.
and in it he speaks to I won't read the whole essay, obviously, it'll take forever. But he says, defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out in the countryside, the cattle are machine gunned, the huts are set on fire. This is called pacification. So you have to be so careful about the way the words are even
Yes,
used
yes.
to define what you're seeing.
Yes.
And then he goes on to say, the transfer of population, millions of people trudging along the road are defined as the transfer of population or rectification of borders. Now, those are the words of governments that are
Yes.
trying to make their efforts seem normalized.
Yes,
And we
absolutely.
see that all the time.
We're going to take a break for our sponsors to pay the bills, and when we come back, Brooke, we will continue our conversation.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the War Room. My name's David Katz, and I am in conversation with Brooke Spector, and we are discussing legacy media. And Brooke, you made a very important point. You said it's necessary, and I agree with that 100%. In order to make sense of the information that we are getting today, one needs to read wide. You have to read widely, and I think deeply. And it takes a lot of work to do that. That's not something that that is easy to accomplish. I remember being on here with Howard Saxton, and he asked me, said to me, "Where do you get your information from?" You know, I couldn't answer him. I mean, I haven't picked up a newspaper in years. I just find the Sunday Times is not what it used to be. The Mail and Guardian and those type of newspapers that used to be my bread and butter, and something enjoyable for me to read. I haven't accessed that for I've lost trust in the legacy media. But certainly, one needs to read wide and one needs to read deep. You need to have the time of it. Point taken on that. We shouldn't take legacy media at its word, and we should always be seeking sources, extra sources, to bolster the type of information that we're getting, to try and triangulate and see where the truth is. But now I want to move, and you touched on this also. I want to move over to the impact of social media, which has totally democratized the whole playing field when it comes to information. So now you have anybody and his computer that can dispense information. And as you said, you can be at the war front with a cell phone and put a picture totally out of context. We don't know what's happening. There seems to be just too much information coming out of there to make any sense of it whatsoever. And we'll talk about this in hybrid warfare also, because I believe that this is the state of confusion that's been sown suits a lot of people in hybrid warfare. But let's just discuss social media and its impact it's had on the legacy media.
Well, one of the things that I'll confess, I don't read deeply into social media, partly because I the things that I'm interested in usually do not get thoughtfully discussed in, say, 800 less than 800 words. You know, a 5 second video clip or a 30 word thing, whatever it might be called, isn't sufficient to help me. It doesn't do. And part of the challenge, I think, now is that far too many younger people not only do not read newspapers, they barely read any source of news, and they don't watch detailed analyses,
Yes.
whether it's on television or electronically. They rely on the social media experience to shape their understanding of things. And you couple that with what's called the juniorization of newsrooms, and you have reporters and correspondents and even editors who have a very thin veneer in many cases of experience and information and knowledge. And the end result is you end up with a seriously superficial view of things that makes you easier prey to people who are populists of one stripe or another, or any number of other political values, which I tend to define antithetical.
Also, Brooks, I mean, it's not only the sort of ersatz little sound bites that people are going after, and they're taking that as news. It's the long formats. I mean, we've got influencers called now influencers that have got long format podcasts that go on for 3-4 hours. Some of them go on for 5 hours, where they fully ventilate a subject matter. And these people have got followings of millions. I mean, they outnumber the legacy media listenership by manyfold. Candace Owens, for instance, has got a listenership running into the millions. Nick Fuentes is in the same situation. Joe Rogan is another one. These guys put out podcasts going for 3 or 4 hours, and they influence the public. They have massive followings, more so than these legacy media outlets. And you've got the youth listening to this, and they're prepared to tune in and listen to it for 3 or 4 hours. So it's not a question of attention span, but in many of these cases, they're just getting the wrong information. Like you say, it's populist, it's propaganda, and it has a certain purpose. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, and I'll speak from the U.S. experience, because I don't know precisely how talk radio evolved in Britain or Europe or elsewhere. But although I do know, I did watch it how it grew in this country once broadcasts other than SABC became popular in the 80s, certainly. 702
with John Robbie and people like that.
All those many people. That was the national conversation, because it allowed people to call in basically unscreened for their political persuasion and untrackable to a considerable degree, and there was this raucous, exciting, even entertaining debate about a country's future. And I used to listen to it a lot when I was here in the 1980s and early 90s, because it was one more finger on yet one more pulse. And it helped people like me understand what people in this country were thinking, with due acceptance of the fact that that wasn't a precise scientific survey of opinion. Yes. It was people who called in on the telephone and who got past the call screener. And it was obviously in a particular language rather than one of 10 others for the most part. In the U.S., the talk radio evolved into the kinds of things you're talking about, the kinds of people that you describe who 30 years ago would have been on talk radio in one station or another.
Yes.
And they have moved over to a different electronic version. Now they are podcasting their bile or their toxic messages for hours on end. For a while, when you traveled across the U.S. by car, say, and you tuned a radio station after a radio station trying to catch a signal, you would catch up with some of these people. The earlier versions, my gosh, I can't remember the man's name.
Howard Stern, with Rush Limbaugh, Howard Stern.
And you know, they were pretty toxic between the two of them.
Yes.
But they were at least entertaining.
Yes.
And you know, they had a sense of humor about the whole thing, as opposed to people now who treat themselves as sort of from God's mouth to their ear kind of purveyors of opinion. What has happened, I think, is that it is now really easy to get into that world. It's really easy to be able to build something like that. Everybody you know has a podcast. Everybody you know has a Substack channel.
Yes.
Everybody you know puts their messages on TikTok and Instagram. And the end result is you have this vast plethora of information that's barely information, but is really, in most cases, unsubstantiated opinion or worse.
Yes, but
it's a
free market of ideas, is it not, Brooks? And it doesn't augur well that a lot of this, as you say, toxic material is top of the pops. People are making the choice.
But it's Gresham's law of information too. Cheap information edges out the more informed stuff, because the more informed stuff requires lots more research and thinking and analysis and examination rather than simply sitting in front of a microphone and talking off the top of your head for 2 hours and explaining that you have an argument about something and you're going to carry it all the way through. I don't know whether there's a way out of this particularly. One of the things, for example, that the New York Times discovered a few years back, they realized that people were not, for the most part, going to their website where all of the stories were neatly arrayed, more or less the way they would have been on the front page and in succeeding sections of the paper.
Yep.
They were responding to the email-driven newsletter that would come out on one issue or another, and they might or might not stumble on the rest of the articles that had been painstakingly put together for the paper.
Yep.
And that means that even if the paper was designed to give you a large picture of many things, people weren't necessarily even bothering to look at it.
Yep.
Now, one other thing that I think we should also add is the simplification of information. And this really goes back to the early days of the newspaper USA Today, if you recall that.
Brooks, can we call it accessibility? Let's use that. Instead of the simplification, would I be right in saying it's the accessibility, making it accessible to the general public instead of it being for an elite few?
Well, it's both in a way. I mean, the USA Today, which was a daily paper published all across the United States, that's something new for America. It's a very different model. Mm. The argument was they never wanted any story longer than 800 words.
Right.
And they insisted that the vocabulary be words that were either in common use among people with about a ninth grade education, which would be what, standard 8 here?
Yeah. Yes.
And if they had to use something else, they would define it in the sentence carefully. And what that was really saying is that they're creating a diet of information for people who don't have knowledge and don't have background and really can't be bothered to dig deep and hard. And that's a problem too.
Okay, so look, there's a necessity in order for the legacy media, and you don't necessarily have to agree with me, but in order for legacy media to remain relevant and open and more accessible to a wider audience and compete, or maybe it doesn't want to compete, I'm not sure, compete with talk podcast, it's going to have to review the model that it's been working with now for decades. And I talked about accessibility. It's going to need to somehow, and I don't mean dumbing it down to the lowest levels, but somehow it's going to have to address the accessibility issues, or otherwise it's fast going to become irrelevant. Is that a true statement, or am I overreading the situation?
To some extent, it is true. If you take the U.S. as a model for this, because it's probably further ahead down that path than most places now, something like 2,000, I think it's 3,000 local and regional newspapers have ceased publication or gone to an online format only. And in the process, they have given up much of the kinds of coverage that used to be the lifeblood of those papers.
Yes.
That's the coverage of the city council's hearing on the restructuring of land use, say. I mean, they used to, papers like that used to cover those things deeply, because people truly were interested in it because it affected them in a direct and substantial way. If somebody is going to get a permit to build an 8-story apartment building next to your 1-story house, you obviously are interested in the outcome of that decision. Now, what that means is that some of those papers have decided, or some of the reporters from those papers that have disappeared have decided, that they need to find a way to recreate that local coverage, even if it's only going to be provided online, and even if it's only going to be episodic every week or something like that. But that bears directly on the way in which an informed public either supports or doesn't support initiatives of government, or makes decisions about how they're going to vote and so forth. And that is a real problem, because you need to have that kind of local, really specific local information to make choices about your governance, well beyond who's going to be prime minister or president or chancellor of the exchequer, say.
But that belongs in the realm of community newspapers, does it not?
Well, community newspapers that are professional, rather than simply repeating a bunch of press releases from public relations specialists, and that also is part of the problem. But there's yet a further problem, and then you find that increasingly, artificial generative intelligence is producing more and more of the content of newspapers.
Yes.
I mean, the Wall Street Journal admitted a couple of months ago that something like 20% of their content is generated through AI mechanisms of one type or another.
And 20%, I would say, is an underestimate. I will guarantee.
Well, I mean, I think we're not counting the tables of stock prices, but, you know, actual reporting. And I did an experiment today. Well, finished it today, actually, with an ex-colleague of mine. I was writing about the 250th anniversary of American independence. And so we asked ChatGPT, what would be the topics that would be important at the 500th anniversary of American independence? And ChatGPT gave me a very, very pessimistic response.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, you've raised an important point, which is artificial intelligence. I want to look at the impact of that on media. Let's take that break.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the War Room. My name is David Katz, and I'm in conversation with Brooks Spector. We are discussing the legacy media and where it is today, and we hit on the subject of artificial intelligence and its impact on reporting these days. And Brooks, I think, we've got to live with it. It's happening. I use it myself as devil's advocate. It's a wonderful tool if used properly. I often ask it to red flag some of the work that I've done, or just take the opposite view totally to what I've done, and some of the results are absolutely amazing. So if it's used correctly, like everything else in this world, if it's used correctly, it can enhance the end product. No doubt about that. I'm sure if it's used in a lazy way and incorrectly, it's going to have a very negative impact on the information that we're getting. We are so overloaded already with irrelevant information and false information that I think AI is going to add to the problem, certainly initially. What do you say about that?
Well, I mean, there have been some examinations of some of the various AI channels that quite clearly seem to have a political bent in one direction or another, so that the information is being skewed. I mean, because there is such material out there, depending on how its algorithm harvests the information and how it's determined that it should be put together, that the unwary can get a result that is really, really going in a particular direction rather than some sort of judicious version of analytical research or, you know, careful analysis. And that goes back to the problem of the juniorization of the the media establishment, generally speaking.
Yes.
That a lot of people are not able to make real substantive decisions about the information because they simply don't know enough.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, you get statements from somebody like Donald Trump who talks about English being the language of the United States for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all right, you laughed, but I mean, he said that. So what do we do with it?
Well,
how are we supposed to respond to something
well,
like
the,
that?
This is these are the times that we live in. I mean, this is what democratization is all about. It means that everybody has an equal vote, no matter who you are, how well informed you are, or not well informed. The elections no longer belong to the elite; it's across the board, and you get the government. You get the government you vote for. What more can I say without putting myself in a position here? So, yeah, it's a dumbing down of a situation.
Yeah, you get the government you have voted for, but there's an obligation on the part of citizens and government both to make sure that the electorate is as well informed as is possible on issues that should matter to them. But unlike you and me, not everybody in a country or is particularly obsessed with or seized by political issues in their society. Lots of people go into voting booths anywhere in the world. They have not yet made up their mind until they reach the point of making the choice of an X or pulling a lever or punching a button or whatever it is, the mechanism they use. And that says that they haven't invested the time and energy to think it through.
No, their vote is equal to yours. You've spent an inordinate amount of time agonizing about the decisions that you're going to make at the ballot box and weighing it up. I mean, you must probably run into weeks and months worth of investigative thought about the politics. And you've got another person that has the exact same vote that you've got, that has spent not 1 second on considering his vote.
Sorry, I lost your voice.
Am I back? Craig? Voice gone. Brooks?
No, your voice, okay, your voice is back.
Oh, okay, great. Sorry, so I'm saying people have equal votes no matter what the educational level or the amount of time that they've spent investigating the issue. There's a certain unfairness about it, I feel.
Well, on the other hand, would you prefer to have one person make all the decisions and, you know, you just have to go along with it, whether you agree with it, like it, or it's inimical to your life? I mean, that's the choice we've had to make. And, you know, it's been said a million times before without hyperbole, as Winston Churchill told us, that democracy is the worst possible form of government except for all the others.
Yes, absolutely. He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. And it's difficult, which is back to the original point that we're saying, it's difficult for people today to actually become informed, even if they want to become informed, because the situation out there is very, very confusing. There's too much information going on, and there are too many sources of information coming through, and it's difficult unless you read wide and deep and you're prepared to spend a lot of time on it, it's difficult to discern what is the objective truth, if there's such a thing, and what isn't. So it as you say, it behooves the press to be as objective as possible and be as informative as possible, especially in a democratic situation.
Now we're edging perilously close to modern philosophy about the question, the entire meaning of objectivity.
Yes. Yes, I'm not a postmodernist, I must tell you, but you can. As I said, I'm not a postmodernist in this thing, and I say to you, yes, a lot of people's opinions are subjective and things are subjective in life, but you can get to a certain amount of objectivity by reading wide and deep and triangulating the information that you get, and where it intersects and crosses over, you must probably getting closer to objectiveness and under normal circumstances, but it takes a hell of a lot of hard work to reach that stage. I don't want to get too much into that at this stage. I want to talk to you and because you said something that's very, very interesting. You haven't touched on investigative reporting. That's something that AI can't do. And have we seen the death of good investigative reporting where somebody goes out and really, really goes into the depth of the situation and goes around there like a sleuth, discovering all the information and bringing it to the table and bringing us the news, something absolutely brand new based on research and based on investigation? Have we seen the death of that?
Curiously, no, actually. I mean, investigative reporting is getting, if it's used properly, various AI tools and other things like that are actually helping a really good investigative reporter. Assume, for example, you're looking into the financial irregularities of a particular business person's relationship with a government figure and the way in which shell companies or other kinds of financial instruments are used. One investigative reporter may not be able to track down all the intricacies of that, but a good internet tool can lead you to the databases that you would go, you know, smack your forehead with your palm and say, of course, I wish I hadn't. I need to know. We need to track that further. And because it can crunch enormous amounts of data at a very fast clip, it can deal with the information you're looking for more quickly than you could possibly do with a giant mound of corporate reports or annual reports piled up on your desk.
Yes.
Now, there's a danger for that too, of course, which is it can take you down some serious rabbit holes that you may never be able to get back from. But I mean, I've seen really good reporters who almost entirely from their desk working space and occasional interviews with people who remind them to look for this and check that and look at the other thing. They do really good work in finding out all the complex interrelationships between politicians and business people and vice versa. Just as Deep Throat apocryphally told the Carl Bernstein and what's his name? Wonderful. Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. I had to look at my bookshelf for a second to remember what the man's name was. It's a curse of old age. what the character the real character apparently told them in the depths of their investigations of the Watergate scandal, follow the money.
Yeah.
Now, they were not good financial analysts, but they were able ultimately to do that. Now it would be much easier to follow that money in some ways.
So AR has certainly can be an aid with that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to discuss with you whether legacy media can change and how it can change if it wants to survive. Let's take that break.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Welcome back to the War Room. My name is David Katz. I'm in conversation with Brooks Spector. Brooks, before I ask you about legacy media and what changes it can do in order to survive, I had a thought in the break about the Bandlanga Commission. Do you not think that that is the preserve of investigative reporting to have brought that to light? We're getting all the information coming out, and it's all news. Decades ago, maybe, that would have been the subject of investigative reporting to get that type of a breakthrough. Or not? Am I being unfair?
I think you're being a little bit unfair because to some extent there has been investigative reporting about police malfeasance or misfeasance all along. And if you remember a couple of years back, the investigations into the rather dubious leases that one Rue Shibangu was arranging with the police. That came to light largely through investigative reporting. I don't know if anybody ever went to jail over that or whether any money was ever paid back. The information was brought forward.
Yeah.
What you're getting now with the ad hoc parliamentary committee and the separate commission is you're getting probably hundreds of new leads for clever and thoughtful and ambitious investigative reporters of one type and another to follow further, because these things do intertwine. Public hearings give you the idea that you need to look further about this or further about that.
Yes.
The investigative reporting gives the commission's leads about what it is they should pursue and how they should pursue it. You only have to look at the removal of a cabinet member not so long, just a couple of months back, for a number of very dubious practices with automobiles handed to their care.
Yep.
And that was brought to light not by government investigators and not by party investigators.
Yes, that was good investigative journalism. Yep.
Old style investigative journalism using modern tools.
Yes. No, absolutely. And there's definitely a place for it. Would you say legacy media has to change if it wants to survive, or is it where it has to be? What would you advise?
Well, it's definitely going to have to change with the times. It's going to have to keep up with the times. It's going to have to figure out ways, editors and others are going to have to figure out ways to bring the information more quickly, more effectively, more comprehensively, but also more comprehensibly to the attention of readers, listeners, and viewers in a way which up until now they have, it's not that they've been lazy, but that they have been complacent, shall we say, until recently that, hey, we've been doing it this way since Ben Franklin first published a newspaper back in the 1700s. And why should we change? Well, the answer is look around you. There is no choice. You must change.
Absolutely.
But what do you want to change into is the question really now. I mean, David, I write for a publication, and my pieces tend to go long, somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 words. And I get complaints sometimes from an editor or a sub-editor, your article is too long. Can't you make it shorter? And my answer usually is, well, I've picked a topic, or I've been asked to pick a topic that is sufficiently complex that much less than we're killing the subject.
No, I agree with you. I've been exactly in that circumstance myself, where you're asked to cut things back, and it's murder. I mean, every word that you lose is a personal loss. Winding up and finishing off, the last question I've got to ask you is, what advice would you give to young people trying to understand the news today? Where to go to? What is the best solution for people wanting to gain a decent understanding of what's going on out there?
Well, somebody asked me the other day, in fact, what should somebody who wants to start a Substack output, what are the things they should do? And I said, read lots of stuff.
Yep.
Read publications whose quality of writing or content is really good and makes you feel like you know more about the topic than you did before. Read good writing. Listen to high quality material. Don't copy it. I mean, I hold a symbol over my head. If you could just write as well as the collective wisdom of the Economist magazine, or my personal essay hero George Orwell, or a few other people, I would be really, really pleased. And the problem with that is they all write long too.
Absolutely. I believe there's nothing wrong with writing long. It's, as you say, things are complex in this world, and it takes complex explanations to unpack everything. Brooks, it's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you. We've got to do this again soon, either on your show or mine. Thank you for coming on, and I've absolutely enjoyed our time together. I wish all the listeners a very, very good evening, and thank you for listening to The War Room.